Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The personal life of a volunteer in the Peace Corps is a story not often told, and when it is told, it's usually only understood by former Peace Corps volunteers. But there are exceptions. The life of Lydia Schaefer is a composite fictional story of a 22-year-old woman who served in the Peace Corps in Peru from 1962 to 1964. Patricia Taylor Edmiston, a former Peace Corps volunteer from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, tells Lydia's story in her book The Morning of Angels, which is based in part on her experiences in the Peace Corps in Peru during those years. Based on my experiences as a volunteer in Peru for 2 years, beginning in 1964, Patricia Taylor Edmiston's story is not too far from the reality of that time. When I finally located Patricia, I spoke with her by phone from her home in western Florida. I asked her to begin by telling us about Lydia Schaefer, and if Lydia is Patricia, or the person Patricia was 40 years ago.
My husband Joe says that Lydia is 67.8% me. Now, what parts of that, I'm not sure. But Lydia has a lot of my characteristics, I think. And yet she has many more insights than I had when I was down there.
What occurred in your life that gave you the ability to put these insights into her character now in your book, The Morning of Angels?
Well, I think the years since my 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in Peru have been enriched by subsequent travel to poor countries throughout Latin America, Asia, Africa. And all of that has gone to make me who I am right now. I suppose a grown-up version of Lydia, and yet someone who desperately wants to share with her own children, stepchildren, and grandchildren some of these insights so that they don't become part of a society that lives a separate reality, that just goes to restaurants and eats at food bars and stuffs themselves and without any awareness about how most of the world lives.
What are some of these insights that you refer to?
Well, one that I don't think I had when I was a Peace Corps volunteer was that poverty just doesn't happen, nor is it ordained by God. It's not simply an accident, but it's the result of decisions that individuals and politicians and governments make, and that we as citizens uphold or work against. That's a big one.
Well, what do you mean uphold?
Well, through our ignorance or through our lack of action, we endorse administrations in this country that never really understand the plight of the poor, the plight of the majority of the people in the world. We are so insulated and isolated from what happens overseas. We think this is the only way of living that exists, and certainly that poor people are in their situations because they haven't worked hard enough. And that just isn't the case.
In sharing those experiences that you have learned in the 40 or so years since you were a Peace Corps volunteer, how do you describe that in the life of Lydia and her experiences in Peru?
Well, Lydia is the child of middle-class parents from Milwaukee. She grew up above a bakery. She grew up within the embrace of the Roman Catholic Church. She had no doubts about her faith. She had no doubts about her way of life.
Up to that point, are we still with you?
Yes, 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 I was very much like that.
Yeah, you grew up above the bakery?
Yes, all of that. That's not to say that I didn't challenge it. When I was a young girl in St. Anne's Elementary School in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, we had to study the lives of the saints. And it was their martyrdoms that so interested me. I couldn't understand how human beings could inflict such pain and torment on others. And I can remember to this day how some of those saints died. And so for me, the notion of torture loomed big, and how people can inflict cruelty on other people and claim then ignorance. But back to
Lydia.
Back to Lydia. That's she goes through in a shorter period of time than I did in understanding the dynamics surrounding poverty and malnutrition, and the role of class and race and the church. She develops these insights more quickly than I, her creator, did.
Well, tell us about where Lydia lived on the first in Arequipa, the second largest city of Peru, and then along the coast.
Well, Arequipa, at the time I was there, was a beautiful city at about the same altitude as Denver, Colorado, surrounded by majestic volcanoes, snow-covered year-round. However, there were slums, or what we called at the time barriadas, now they're known as pueblos jóvenes, or young towns. There were 52 surrounding Arequipa at the time, and our group of Peace Corps volunteers, after we arrived, many of us sick from dysentery from Lima, overland by bus, were spread out around these different barriadas. And everything was very, very barren. There was nothing green, and there were just gray stone or tin shacks. There was no water, there was no electricity, there was no plumbing. And this is the world that we entered after we left Lima for our different assignments. And then Lydia, like I, moved to the coast, to Ica, Peru. And Ica is in a desert. There are rivers that flow from the Andes when the snows melt. And Lydia works on the side of one of these dry riverbeds that, when the snows melt, becomes a sewer, polluted. People have used the dry riverbed as their toilet, and all the trash goes into it. And the children are so relieved when the water finally fills the riverbed that they swim in it. And disease is rampant, and flies are everywhere. And Lydia tries to cope with this situation.
How does she cope?
Well, she drinks some wine, that's part of it, and she does a lot of praying. Friends are a major part of her life and solace and the support. A lot of dark humor, I think, and a misplaced love affair where her sanctity, all of the proper ways in which she was brought up kind of go out the window, and she suffers guilt because of it. All of that. Everything is challenged. And she gets sick. She gets horribly sick.
And then she meets a doctor who changes her life.
Yes, yes. This is Rafael Serrano. He's a mixed-race doctor. He's interning. She brings him to the clinic that she's working in on the site of that horrible river. And he works with the Indians and with the mestizos, and he's kind and he's gentle, and there's none of the racism, him being half Indian and half Spanish. He's gentle and loving, and they develop a mutual respect for one another.
So was there a Raphael or a doctor of similar character in your life when you lived there in 1962 and 63?
Raphael is a composite, I think, of everything I admire in men, the best qualities of wonderful men that I've known. I would love to tell you that Raphael really existed and that this splendid doctor is down there someplace, and he is, in that he is in my mind and he is in the minds of so many Peruvians and among the Indian people there. But Raphael is a composite. And I lived with him and I dreamed with him and I dreamed of him while I was writing this book, and to that extent, oh, indeed, he lives.
The various trips, they too were composites, the trips to the Sierras?
The trips were all taken. They were lived. The different experiences are spliced together in a fictional way, because after all, this is a novel. And yet I would say that the first part of it uses some memoir within it. But yes, the journey that Lydia and Raphael take together is the result of real experience. It's the result of research, both of those combined, and a lot of imagination.
Patricia, there are many people who have traveled to Peru or who dream of traveling to Peru. And you talk about traveling to Cusco and then most of the way to Machu Picchu and beyond. Tell us about those and how they're portrayed through your life and Lydia's life in your book, The Morning of Angels.
Well, keep in mind that this is set in the early 60s, and Lydia knew nothing about the geography of Peru until she started traveling there. So her eyes are wide open, and she's traveling the high plateau from Arequipa to Puno, and she passes altitudes well above 15,000 feet. And she looks out the window, and she sees the llamas and the alpacas, and she has to drink coca tea to prevent her from passing out. And then she gets to Lake Titicaca and the profound blue depths of that lake, and the people who live there, and the women in their bowler hats, and the train stations where roasted goat is sold, and white goat cheese, and cold, large kerneled corn. Everything is new and exciting, and she makes a lot of mistakes, one major one with the Indians, and she feels horrible guilt about that. The train to Cusco, following the serpentine paths around the mountains with their terraces, it is an amazing trip for her. And the sun comes over from Brazil and crosses over those Andes and brings sun and fertility to the land. Lydia visits the ancient Inca sites in Cusco, Sacsayhuaman and Ollantaytambo and Machu Picchu. So the reader sees what Lydia sees through the train windows and experiences the full flavor. I think I had an agent read the book, and she said that she felt that she had finally made the journey to Peru, that it came alive for her by reading it. And, of course, Lydia and Raphael travel to his village. And then later, because of political intrigue and political oppression and a rebellion among the Indians, which actually historically happened, because much of the book is historically set, and there is a rebel figure based on the life of real rebel Hugo Blanco. And well, I don't want to divulge too much, but there's a lot in the book that draws from history, the notion of lost civilizations and places where the Spanish had never entered.
I'd like you to tell us about those lost civilizations, but I do want to say that this week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Patricia Taylor Edmiston, the author of The Morning of Angels, a fictitious biography of a Peace Corps volunteer who lived and worked in Peru from 1962 to 1964. I personally was a Peace Corps volunteer in Peru 2 years after that, and based on what Patricia is telling us now, her characterizations about Lake Titicaca and the way it looks and smells and the sun rising from Brazil, when I visited Peru in February of 1998, I found that still to be the case. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Patricia, tell us about these Indian traditions, the Indian villages that you observe, that I observe, that Lydia talks about.
Well, I think it's important to realize that for the Indian, everything resides in the geography of the land, in rocks, in water, in and also in the universe, the moon and the sun god, Viracocha, the creator of everything. There's the myth of the flood and how the children of Viracocha, the first Inca and his sister wife, arose out of Lake Titicaca and were told by Viracocha to settle the earth, to populate and to multiply and to populate the earth. And they carried a golden staff. They were to head in the direction of Cusco, and where that golden staff entered the ground easily, there they were to develop their families. And even now, Cusco, to the Indians, is known as the umbilicus of the universe. There's a sacredness about the earth and rocks, and they're called Apus, A-P-U-S, and they're embodied with a certain divinity. And all of these cultural and religious traditions, I've tried to weave in and out of Lydia's story, to bring them to the reader, to enrich their understanding of life for the Andean Indian, for whom, who were literally strangers to Lydia before she got there, despite her training at Cornell University. And I should point out that the Morning of Angels, the word morning, is spelled M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. And that title derives from a line in a letter that was written to the King of England in the 1600s by a man named John Phillips, who was visiting Peru, and he was commenting on the dreadful treatment of the Indians by the Spanish, and he said, "These are enormities to make the angels mourn," and therefore the title.
Patricia, are there some portions of your book that you could read for us?
Yes, I'll read a little bit about from Lydia's training period. She's in a Spanish language class, and she always seems to meet people that cause problems, whose views she challenges. And in that regard, she's pretty much like me. All right. Fernando Arroyo, my Spanish teacher, is a petite, narrow-faced Mexican graduate student. Although his main job is teaching Spanish, he spends a lot of time criticizing the Catholic Church. "The church is like a comfortable mattress for the people," he says. "It puts them to sleep so they don't have to take responsibility for their own actions." I feel the quivering in my stomach that tells me I want to respond, but am unsure of what to say. Noting my distress, he says, "Miss, do you have a problem with what I just said?" Where I grew up, the church stressed individual responsibility, I blurt, feeling my face flush, wishing I had kept my mouth shut, but the Jesuits had taught me to question. Ah, Miss Schaefer, right? A good Catholic girl, no? You think the church can do no wrong because you've never been exposed to anything outside of your perfect little hometown. You know nothing about the world, and now you think you're going to save it. He spits out the last few words. Thinking I'm too rigid to work in Peru, Fernando refers me for psychological testing. But the psychologist decides I'm sufficiently flexible to deal with a new culture and recommends I transfer to a different Spanish class and keep a low profile. A rumor circulates that a Peace Corps assessment officer is posing as a trainee in our group, spying on us, trying to weed out those who could become problems once in Peru. Then, with only 3 weeks of training left, 8 men from Peace Corps Washington come to evaluate our progress and pore over our files and test scores. 3 young male trainees and 1 older woman slip away. They have been deselected. The next cut will take place in Puerto Rico.
Well, Patricia, I find what you wrote to be very similar to my experience of training in Cornell.
Yeah, I think that they were still under we're in the middle of the Cold War era, and that they brought that way of thinking to training.
That's right.
For us, and they wanted to get rid of people who might have been too liberal in their thoughts or had a different viewpoint.
I found that they wanted to get rid of people, not for political reasons, but people who wouldn't be able to stand the difference in culture and their different life.
I'm certain that's true, and Lydia was brought up in such a fashion that she would have posed those questions for them.
There's another section that I'd like to ask you to read, and that's when Lydia and Raphael are moving towards the community where he was born and grew up.
Yes, up until this time, they had a chaste relationship, and they were traveling through the mountainous region. They had just left Machu Picchu, where they had spent the night, and they are climbing at this particular point, trying to reach the last pass in the valley where Raphael's family lives. Continuing upward toward the pass, my lungs protest, wanting to burst from my chest. I collapse on the mossy ground when we reach the top. A cloud obscures our view of the valley below us, but soon the sun opens a narrow window, permitting a glimpse of the emerald land and a glistening river. Is Pacha Buena in that valley, I ask? Yes, but before we descend, I want to show you the surprise I promised this morning. I hear water and walk toward the stream rising from the ground. Hot, sulfurous water pours down a turquoise, mineral-encrusted channel to a small pool. I bend to touch the water. Cuidado, Lydia! It's very hot, Raphael warns. Come over here, to this pool, where cold water mixes with the hot. We undress and slip into the pool. You are very beautiful, Lydia, Raphael says. You look like an Inca Colla. A shy queen, I say. The bath is narrow and deep. We rest our heads on the stone ledge and let our bodies bob in the steaming, bubbling water. I have never been further from Milwaukee. Refreshed and relaxed, we climb out and recline on top of our clothes. My drying body prickles in the sun. I roll on my side to look at Raphael, who appears to be sleeping, his hands cradling his head. The skin on the inside of his arms is a smooth olive color, and he has very little hair under his arms. The bones of his chest are outlined under tightly drawn copper skin. And the reader will have to get the book to figure out what happens next.
Patricia, where is Lydia now?
Lydia, she is my child, in a sense.
Will we see her in future writings?
That may happen. It has been wished by readers that Lydia's life continues in another book.
Patricia, I'd like to ask you about the Peace Corps and your reflections on having been a volunteer.
The Peace Corps was a 2-year experience that changed me forever and continues to influence me, to inform my life, to inform the decisions that I make. The early years, I was much more reactionary as a result of the Peace Corps. I had a terrible time adjusting when I returned to Wisconsin. As modest as a home I was that I lived in, the refrigerator was well stocked. There was cold milk that I had missed for so long and wonderful Wisconsin dairy products. And I had a beautiful bedroom. And instead of being gracious and appreciative to my parents, I tended to cut them off, and, you know, that somehow they could never understand what I had been through, what most of the people in the world were living, and I don't know what I expected of them.
Well, Patricia Edmiston, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, one I just finished was called The Accidental Pope, by Raymond Flynn and Robin Moore. Raymond Flynn was mayor of Boston and ambassador to the Vatican. And the accidental part of that title comes from the fact that a fisherman from New England is accidentally selected as the Pope to succeed John Paul II. He had been a priest. He had received a dispensation to marry. After his wife's death, he continued with his fishing business. He had 4 children, I believe, and he becomes Peter II. And as Peter II, learning the ropes in the Vatican, bringing his children to read there, fresh air rolls through, and there are many changes, including the possibility of an invitation to priests who have been married to return to the priesthood, a look at the ordination of women, another look at birth control, these issues that are important to me now. So it was with great delight that I discovered that book.
Well, Patricia Edmiston, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry.
Patricia Taylor Edmiston is the author of The Morning of Angels, a story about a Peace Corps volunteer in the early 1960s. The book she recommends is The Accidental Pope, by Raymond Flynn and Robin Moore. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available at cost for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. Here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again next week.